this week as defender of Black life pulled down Confederate monuments across the country, we must also take this moment to re-examine our past and our substantial role in perpetuating white supremacy. It's time to take down some of our own monuments. The House passed a bipartisan measure to allocate $900 million a year to acquire and preserve more land for public use and to spend $9.5 billion on the U.S. national parks over the next 5 years. The National Wildlife Federation described the Great American Outdoors Act as the most significant investment in conservation in decades. The FBI has arrested the Republican Speaker of Ohio's House of Representatives, Larry Householder, in connection with a $60 million bribery scheme. Householder is accused of helping pass a $1.1 billion bailout of two nuclear plants after his political operation was paid $60 million from the owners of the plant. First Energy Solutions. The company is not facing charges and is not named in the indictment. In Louisiana, an appeals court ruled the Bayou Bridge Pipeline Company trampled the rights of landowners by starting construction of the highly contested pipeline without the permission of the landowners. Across the United States, gas flare lights the night skies over oil and gas fields, visible symbols of the country's energy boom. They also emit greenhouse gases. New research on gas flares suggests that the practice poses a significant risk to expectant mothers. Now our show.
This is Eco Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Brent Ragsdale. Tonight's show is all about carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere, both the whys and the hows, and I'm excited to have two really good guests. On the phone with me tonight from British Columbia is Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock. Alex, welcome to Eco Radio KC.
Thanks very much, Brent. It's great to be down in Kansas.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about Radio EcoShock. I'm a big fan. I've been listening for years, but for some reason, we don't have that on our community radio station here, and so I want you to plug it a little bit.
Well, basically, the plan is to get the voice of scientists directly out to the public about what we are learning, cutting-edge learning about climate change and the risks that we face. I cover other environmental issues, but climate change seems to be the big one that's going to change not just our lives, but our kids' lives and our grandchildren's lives. So I've been doing that for about 14 years. We have over 100 nonprofit stations put this out. There's no advertising or commercials. The whole idea is just to get the word out to people about what we're facing and also what we can do about it.
All right. Well, I can't think of anyone I'd rather interview tonight to help me explain why we've got to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So I want to keep this at a fairly high level, I guess. I don't want to deconstruct the science all the way back down to, you know, the fact that how greenhouse gases work. We're going to take that as a given. But what I want to start with, I want you to explain to us first this idea of climate sensitivity that you covered in one of your recent shows. Tell us how that works.
Yes, I spoke with Tim Linton, who's a modeling professor, and also Tim Palmer in the UK. And what they're finding, scientists have been trying to figure out, well, what happens if you double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from what there was in pre-industrial times before we started burning coal? So say around 1750, 1780, and we know what the carbon levels were then by testing the bubbles in ice. We can measure it. So what they are trying to figure out is what would happen if you double it, and they call that climate sensitivity. The general feeling up until a few years ago, and this is based on a lot of cutting-edge science, is that we would warm about 3 degrees Celsius, so that's quite a bit more in Fahrenheit. And that's the global average, so it would be even warmer on land. Well, now new research and the latest models are showing actually it could go up to 5 degrees Celsius global average mean warming, and that could mean warming perhaps up to 9 degrees Fahrenheit right there in Kansas. so that summers would be longer and very much hotter. Now, the way that they've had to work this out using models, it's not perfect. They're always having to change it a little bit, but they're getting better and better as you use supercomputing power, and they can compare it by running them backwards and say, well, would it have predicted the last ice age? And now they've got it so that it does. So we have more confidence in this, and what it means is we're headed towards a kind of hell for our kids and our grandkids if we just let this run. We do have to act. It's a national crisis, an emergency, really.
Yeah, more than national, international. So taking stock of where we are, you mentioned that prior to us starting to burn fossil fuels and put the CO2 waste into the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was around, you said, 280 parts per million. And now I believe we're approaching 415 parts per million.
Slightly over that, yeah.
Slightly over that, yeah. So if you talk about the doubling, so if you take 280 parts per million and double that, that's 560. But halfway to that 560 would be 420. So we're really approaching the halfway mark to that kind of arbitrary thing that science uses that they call climate sensitivity. So a big question that you raised in your remarks from this latest Radio EcoShock episode was nobody really knows how long it's going to take us to get to that steady state higher temperature. We've got these models that kind of predict what we think it will be, but there are various ranges for, you know, how long it's going to take. It may be centuries. So is that a true statement?
Well, I wouldn't say centuries. I think it will likely happen within this century if we keep going vaguely at the rate we're at now. Now, a lot of things could change. We could have a collapse of industrial civilization, so we emit a lot less CO2. We could have new technology comes out that could suck it out of the air. We could have a big change of heart in society where we decide, well, we're just going to fly less and drive less and burn less carbon. So the human variable is very large. But if you just take the emissions as they've been going from 2015, 2016, up to 2019, and add them up, it looks like the year 2067 or 2070 would be the time when we hit that doubling point, and therefore at least 3 degrees C hotter as a global mean average, and maybe 5 degrees if this new science and new modeling is correct.
Yeah, so if you plot that out, you get a very steep curve in the temperature just happening now. Basically, the CO2 has kind of a slow effect on the temperature of the planet. It takes a long time kind of to catch up and get to a steady state. Is that correct?
That is right. Even if we double it by 2070, that doesn't mean it will be right then and there 3 degrees or 5 degrees C hotter. Because the ocean soaks up so much heat, and then it takes a while for the ocean to mix down and release it again. So it could be, well, Tim Palmer thought 200 or 300 years would be a more accurate way to look at when we would reach those very high temperatures. But keep in mind, it's getting hotter all along, and 2020 may very well be the hottest year we've ever experienced. It's roasting right across the south, as you know very well. And it's roasting in Siberia. This is a really hot year, and it's just going to get hotter as we go along. We don't have to wait for the doubling time to experience some terrible things from climate change.
And one prediction that you cited on your show notes was from the esteemed climate scientist Michael Mann, that he predicts that we'll be to a 2-degree warmer world by as soon as 2036. So that kind of brings it home a little bit more. It's not quite as abstract as thinking about 2100.
Well, and parts of the land will reach it long before then. I talked to an Indian scientist who said that in India, for 9 months of the year, they've already exceeded 1.5 degrees C hotter than pre-industrial. And that 1.5 was sort of the last stop for what we would consider a safe climate. They're already surging past that, and other countries are doing so as well. So on land, we're going to pass those records before the whole world does, because remember, the majority of the Earth's surface is ocean, and it, as you know, when you try and boil a pot of water, it takes a while to heat water up, but then it maintains its heat for a long time, so the ocean will then release heat back into the Earth for centuries.
Yes, and those hotter temperatures on land, like in India, have caused already just terrible ramifications socially. I know that there's been a lot more suicide with the farming community in India. We know that climate disruption has increased the stresses in the Middle East and caused a lot of people to try to get to Europe or other places where they might have a better chance at surviving. So there's a lot of ramifications. And your show has done a great job over the years looking at all of the different science and papers around increases in wildfires, biodiversity loss, coral reef destruction from acidifying and heating oceans, a lot of really dire things. One that really stands out in my mind was from, I looked it up, it was from 2017. It was a show called Fatal Heat Warning, and you interviewed a scientist from the University of Hawaii named Camillo Mora, and he was talking about studies of the effects of heat stroke. And as I recall, he was saying that a lot of times in populations, you can see a few years after a big heat event that there's a statistical increase in deaths because it affects us so much. Do you remember that interview?
I do, and that's a fabulous interview. I think his paper was titled 27 Ways Heat Can Kill You, and he found that people hadn't really researched how heat does work and some of the ways that heat kills, and it kills a lot of people. It's the greatest natural hazard cause of death, for example, in Australia, and it's killing Americans by the thousands every year. We have to remember that. But some of the ways that it kills are a little bit reminiscent of COVID-19 because it also can disturb the blood system and the distribution of the blood so that you get blood clotting. There are after effects that can last for years. You can have organ damage from extreme heat. And the same thing is happening with COVID-19. So I think there are parallels.
Yes. So I think we've pretty well established that we can't let this happen. We've got to slow down our emissions, and then I believe we're going to have to figure out ways to not only stabilize the CO2 levels in the atmosphere, but actually bring them back down. And that's what we're going to be talking about later in the show. I have a great guest on from a nonprofit called Carbon 180, Guyana Amador, and we're going to talk about all the ways that we may be able to do that and what it's going to take in terms of funding for research. But I just am really happy that I got to talk to you about this. I've been a big fan of Radio EcoShock. I hope that we can get it on to KKFI in the future. And maybe before I let you go, I want to make sure that we have gotten this point across about the lag, you know, that we've put this CO2 in the atmosphere. It really acts as a thermostat for the planet. In fact, in your show notes, you make that comparison. I tend to try to explain this to people, the lag. Like, you've got a house, you keep bumping up the thermostat, and before it really catches up, your heating system really catches up, you bump it up some more. And that's what we keep doing. And I think we're to the point now that we're going to realize, oh, it's way too hot to live. We've got to figure out a way to bring it down. And so we'll be talking a lot about that in the rest of the show. But any parting thoughts for us here in Kansas City, Alex, before I let you go?
Well, there are just so many ways and things we haven't talked about. One of them is river flooding. Right now in China, there's massive river flooding. Millions of people have had to leave their homes. There have been hundreds of deaths. A third of Bangladesh is underwater. And while we're all busy with COVID and American news and the president, we forget that these things are happening on the other side of the world, but they're coming to our side of the world. And anybody on the Missouri River and on the Mississippi River knows about river flooding, and we're going to see more of that. We've got all the concerns about crop damage, and any agricultural state is going to be paying attention to that, how hot it can get before our crops just can't grow or we have to switch to different crops. You talked to me about the dry line advancing. Kansas and Missouri are just states that are right open to extreme weather events. We've got the super storms coming up. This is a threat multiplier, and we've got to do something about it. And I'm so pleased that your show is going to take on some of the things that we could do about it. In addition to cutting emissions, we're going to have to grab some of this carbon dioxide out of the air as part of our economy. And that's going to be an exciting new challenge. I hope we can do it.
Yeah, that you're bringing up the river. The Missouri River is very topical. We just had three guests on a couple of weeks ago, and we're going to have them on again, you know, talking about what it's going to take to make the rivers more resilient to flooding issues, because it's a fact, it's coming. One exciting thing about our area in terms of solutions is that we do have an abundance of wind power here. We aren't always the most progressive politically in Kansas, but boy, do we have wind. And I think that it's going to take a lot of green energy to power these solutions. So I'm excited about the possibilities of what our area can do in the future.
Well, you may be the one of the new energy states for the rest of the country.
Yes, very much so. And we've hardly tapped into solar, and we've got plenty of sunshine, too. So the future is bright in that regard.
It is.
Well, Alex, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for calling in. I will post this. Our show is put out as a podcast, like your show. I usually catch your show at ecoshock.org on Wednesdays. That's when the podcast gets posted, because we don't carry it on our radio station. But I know it comes out a few days earlier than that on a lot of radio stations, our sister stations around the country, and a lot of college stations. So thank you very much for what you've done, all the education you've given me, and what you've done to help us solve these problems.
Well, thanks for calling me up, and it's good to talk to the people in KC.
Well, I guess I better do something with that old thing. Fine, honey, I'll get rid of it. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, you can turn your used-up car, boat, truck, van, or motorcycle into the programs you know and love right here on KKFI. All you have to do is go to kkfi.org, find the support tab to donate your wheels, rudders, or handlebars, or you can call 816-931-3122 and ask for the development department. That's 816-931-3122, or go to kkfi.org. Thank you so much for your support, and remember, you can hear your old ride in your new one.
This is a KKFI public service announcement. The United Community Services and Cities of Johnson County are currently conducting a housing market and needs assessment, of which the findings will be used for a 10-year outlook to determine future housing policies. If you live in Johnson County, please go to ucsjoco.org to complete a brief survey to give input into the future housing needs in your community. This has been a public service announcement from KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome back to Eco Radio. Tonight we're talking about the prospects for removing carbon from the atmosphere. Our next guest is Gianna Amador, co-founder and managing director of a group called Carbon 180. Gianna, welcome to Eco Radio KC.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right. So I think you heard the first interview with Alex Smith, where we talked about the needs for not only reducing how much carbon we put into the atmosphere, but actually starting to draw it back out. So there aren't many groups I've noticed that are really on board with that message and have that as a goal, but your group, Carbon 180, is. Tell us about your group and how you got started and how you personally got interested.
For us, it was really about the climate map. When my co-founder and I met Noah Deitch, we really knew that in order to meet our climate goals, and that's really to limit climate change and warming to below 2 degrees Celsius or 1.5 degrees Celsius, that the climate models were telling us that we needed to not only reduce our emissions, but also clean up carbon that was already in the atmosphere. And there were a number of academics who were talking about this need, but no one else was really working on making these solutions a reality. So there was this gap that we could fill as an organization if we were solely focused on bringing these carbon removal solutions to scale and really fixing that missing piece. So in 2015, we founded Carbon 180 to bring a new set of climate solutions to the table. As an organization, we bring together scientists, policymakers, and businesses to build an economy that removes more carbon from the atmosphere than we emit.
Wow, that sounds great. Locally in Kansas City, there is a lot of interest in climate action. In fact, there's a group, I would say the most prominent group is actually called Climate Action KC, and they have lots of local politicians, mayors, and council people, and some state representatives from both Kansas and Missouri, and they're really doing great things. They tend to use the Drawdown book from Paul Hawkins as a model, which I do think is great for reduction. But I don't know that people have really gotten their heads around this idea that we know reduction is not going to be enough. We've got to actually start coming up with ways to draw it down. So your group, I read on your website, carbon180.org, that you sponsored a group a few years ago called the New Carbon Economy Consortium, which sounds really interesting. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. The New Carbon Economy Consortium is an alliance of 14 universities and national labs across the country that are working together to achieve this vision of a new carbon economy. And that's what I mentioned before about this prosperous, growing economy that really captures and stores more carbon than it emits. And together, these universities came together around 2017 to establish a shared research agenda, which we published on our website called an Innovation Roadmap. And we continue to come together around the priorities listed in that roadmap and to pose new research questions, collaborate on research projects, share lessons and resources, and really to build the next generation of climate champions. So it's about thinking about the needs and the gaps around the science in order to bring these solutions to scale, and how can universities and academics across the country really drive that change.
So is that something that people could find on your website if they were wanting to dig into the details?
Absolutely. It's at carbon180.org/new carbon economy.
All right. Yeah, I knew the answer to that question because I actually downloaded it and got through quite a bit of it. It's impressive. I thought we might use that as a framework for our talk today. So you break the, in that report, you break down the solutions into kind of three types of buckets of solutions: energy solutions, biological solutions, and then hybrids of both. Let's unpack that. What do you mean by energy or by engineering solutions?
Yeah, so there are two main ways to capture carbon. One is through photosynthesis, and that's on natural or land-based systems. And the other is engineered or through a chemical process. So specifically, these are technologies that we develop that use chemical processes to separate carbon dioxide from the air around us. And that really includes a suite of different technologies. The one that's most often talked about is called direct air capture, but there's also what we call at Carbon 180 carbon tech, or carbon utilization. So that's where we turn carbon dioxide into valuable products. And the last one that's maybe a little bit more nascent is called enhanced weathering or carbon mineralization. And that's really about speeding up the natural weathering of rocks in order to turn that carbon dioxide from the air into a sort of solid mineral or carbonate. And so those are really the three big buckets of solutions that we're referring to when we talk about engineered carbon removal solutions.
Yeah, so I know your group kind of stays agnostic to different businesses, but I'll throw out a couple of names that I'm aware of. There's one direct air capture company in Canada called Carbon Engineering. There's one in Switzerland called Climeworks. There's also a company that I know of called Carbon Cure that's trying to make cements that are, instead of being a process that creates a lot of carbon dioxide that would go into the atmosphere, it actually reduces the amount. So I know those aren't the only ones. They've got lots of people working on those, and I think that's great. So your group is really about awareness and then building the policies and then also getting the funding and the necessary kind of early stage R&D going at different universities and nonprofits so that we can turn those things into businesses that make a profit. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And we really think of these carbon removal solutions at the stage that we saw solar and wind in the 70s and 80s. It took decades of university research, federal government research and development, financing of demonstration projects, regulations that supported public-private partnerships and optimal financing mechanisms to really then bring these renewable energy solutions to scale. So we saw the cost of solar come from about $70 per watt down to about 7 cents per watt. And that was through this sort of chain of supportive policies and private sector actions that were able to bring these solutions to maturity. And so we're trying to find that similar path for carbon removal solutions and say, how do we take them from where they are today and really scale them to the point at which they can be a big part of this climate fight?
You talked about the weatherization, the idea that you could possibly get the carbon dioxide or methane, which is CH4, carbon and hydrogen, but get the carbon molecules sequestered into the ground as some sort of a mineral rock. The Earth does that. The carbon cycle does that, but it just takes a really long time. So you're talking about ways that we could engineer that to happen faster, which I think is great. So what other kinds of products do you think might be possible that people would want to pay for so that we could have a new economy that would be based on not viewing carbon as a waste product, but really more as a resource?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things that personally gets me really excited about carbon removal is that it's sort of this shift in the way that we think about carbon pollution. Obviously, the fundamental problem of climate change is that there are 2 trillion tons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that is causing planetary warming along with a number of other really, catastrophic impact. But carbon isn't necessarily bad. It's just in the wrong place. But it's really a fundamental part of our planet and our lives. And so we can transform that carbon from a liability into an asset and turn it into a number of different products. On the land side, we can store carbon in our soils in ways that make our farms more fertile and more resilient to climate impacts. In forests, we can reforest and manage our forests better to prevent against wildfires and also create a number of different harvested wood products. There's been a lot of innovations around building taller skyscrapers out of wood and using wood as a valuable material to store carbon in our built environment. And then finally, there's this sector that I mentioned earlier called carbon tech. And really, that's the conversion of CO2 that's usually sourced from direct air capture machines, like the companies Carbon Engineering and Climeworks that you mentioned earlier, and converting that through a process to make a number of different carbon-based materials. So that could be consumer goods like shoes, could be plastics, fuels, chemicals, cements. Really, the list goes on and on. And about 2 years ago, Carbon 180 did an analysis of all the different products that could be created from carbon removal. And it turns out that there's a $1 trillion market in the U.S. for products made from carbon, as well as over a $6 trillion market for products made globally. And so this is a huge potential for these products to be embedded in our economy.
Yeah, that's exciting. I've been following one of the XPRIZE contests. I'm sure you're aware of that, for carbon removal, basically trying to incentivize for a prize groups to come up with ideas and test it. One of the teams that I'm really excited about came out of research from George Washington University. So there was a chemist there named Stuart Licht, and his group has a process that the company is actually called carbon to carbon nanotubes. So it's a way to make a very high value product out of the carbon that's in the atmosphere, which would be graphite type nanotubes that could then be used for carbon fibers and all manner of high-tech batteries and things like that. So I think that's a good example of this kind of carbon tech that you're talking about. Okay.
Absolutely.
We are going to take a little break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about the other one, which was the biological and hybrid methods. All right.
Every Tuesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m., Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced public affairs program, spotlights individuals and organizations in our community that deal with ideas and issues of social and political significance, such as climate change, racial and gender inequality, pay inequity, and much, much more. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesdays, 6 to 6:30 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. Wind energy is good for the climate, but scientists estimate that wind turbines kill more than 500,000 bats in the U.S. each year. Migratory species like the hoary bat are the most vulnerable. Research by Winifred Frick of Bat Conservation International shows that if nothing is done to protect them, hoary bat populations could drop by up to 90% within 50 years.
The level of mortality that we see is high enough that it could potentially cause rapid declines of that species.
But she says there are ways for bat species and wind energy to thrive. For example, during migration season, wind turbines can be turned off on nights when the wind is low. Studies show this could reduce bat fatalities by about 50 to 90%, with only minimal effects on energy production.
We've learned a lot in the last 10 years in terms of the interactions between bats and wind turbines that can really point towards effective solutions.
Now the challenge is implementing those solutions widely. But Frick says she's optimistic that by focusing on the issue,
we can have renewable energy and we can protect biodiversity. I don't think that those are mutually exclusive outcomes.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for listening to EcoRadio KC. My guest is Gianna Amador from Carbon 180, and we're talking about prospects for removing carbon from the atmosphere. So, Gianna, we talked about engineered methods for removing carbon. How about biological ways?
Yeah, absolutely. So, natural ecosystems cycle carbon. We touched upon this in the first segment about how carbon removal is really intertwined with the natural carbon cycle, and moving carbon from the atmosphere to the biosphere as well as the geosphere. And I think we can all remember learning that photosynthesis equation when we were in middle school, but really it just comes down to plants capture atmospheric CO2 in the process of creating food for themselves through photosynthesis. And then plants take that carbon dioxide and store it in their own biomass, so like trees, and then also in the soils. And so through specific land management practices, we can harness the power of nature in order to store more carbon. And the main ecosystems that do this are really forests, agricultural soils, and then wetland ecosystems. And there's also a potential for urban environments and specifically urban forestry to play a big role in bolstering the power of our natural systems.
I've heard that the Earth has more carbon in the soil than in the atmosphere. Have you heard that?
I have. The soil actually holds about 3 times more carbon than the atmosphere.
Yeah. So just wrapping your mind around that makes you think that there is potential that if we could just slightly increase the amount of carbon that's stored in soil, then we could have a big effect. I want to talk about a group called the NORI Marketplace. It was actually Christoph Jospe who suggested that I talk to you, which I really appreciate that. I'm a fan of that idea. I listen to their podcast called Reversing Climate Change. I listened to you and Noah do an episode of that a few years ago. Can you explain the NORI Marketplace concept for our listeners?
This is something that I'm really personally excited about. I grew up in an agriculture community in the Central Valley of California, and NORI is working to help ag producers on their farms and ranches across the U.S. To help them transition their operation to practices that store carbon. We know that certain farming practices can store more carbon in the soils, and these practices include things like cover crops, no-till systems, rotational grazing, compost applications. And actually, just to take a step back a little bit, Carbon 180 has been working with farmers and ranchers in the Rocky Mountain West to transition these operations. And we found 3 big barriers that farmers were facing in adopting these practices: education, science, and incentives. And NORI is really focused on that last piece around incentives. So they're creating a marketplace where farmers and businesses come together to store carbon in soils. So the farmers get paid $15 per ton of CO2 for storing carbon in their soils, and businesses can buy those credits to help with their corporate commitments and to help reduce their personal footprint. And what NORI is really focused on is building that marketplace and also supporting farmers in measuring their carbon impact.
Yeah, that's exciting. So you have a similar background to the folks in Kansas City. I mean, we're an agricultural area. You don't have to drive too far to find big ag farms. And I think an exciting thing about NORI's idea is that they are trying to work with big ag. They are trying to make, which I think is going to make a huge difference. I mean, it's one thing to get the greenies to do their, you know, their own little permaculture garden in the backyard, which I think is great. There are a lot of those, and there's a lot of people that have yards that could actually be managed in a different way. And if we all did a little, that would amount to a lot. But the food systems that feed the whole world are massive amounts of land. And if we could just increase that storage slightly, it would be a great thing. It seems like their challenge is going to be a lot around how do you verify, how do you measure the soil, how do you know that the farmers are keeping it in the ground? Yeah, so do you think that your group and the research that you would help arrange or fund or at least get going would help them in that regard?
Definitely. I think it's all very interconnected. Anyone who's working on soil carbon storage in agriculture has a big question about how we monitor and verify the carbon that's stored in soils and make sure that it actually stays there. I think that's one of the main challenges of natural systems is that the soil carbon storage is less durable over time. So we really want to make sure that we can verify the changes that are happening and account for the fact that natural systems have fluxes of carbon. And I think the New Carbon Economy Consortium research and development that's happening at the federal level, as well as research in some of these labs of major food companies, can sort of come together to help us find ways to measure and verify carbon in a way that's really not expensive or difficult for the farmer to implement. And that's sort of a key barrier right now is we know how to do it, but we don't know how to do it with ease and at scale, which is important.
Yeah. So on the smaller scale, what do you think about biochar? Do you think there's potential for biochar to help bring carbon out of the atmosphere?
Yeah, and just for the audience, biochar is a land-based solution where you essentially burn biomass. It could be agriculture residue, dead trees, walnut shells, in a really low oxygen environment to basically create a form of charcoal that can potentially store carbon for a long period of time. And it's usually added as an amendment to the soil to help with things like water filtration and, you know, general health of the soil. I think there's a potential for biochar to be a powerful carbon removal solution, but there are a lot of variables that matter when it comes to whether the climate benefits really pencil out for biochar. So everything from what are you using as your feedstock to how you convert that and then what you do with the char with it when it's done. So it's really an area where we need more research in order to really understand the life cycle impacts of biochar.
Yeah, I appreciate that, because if you drive your gas sucking pickup around to get the wood and then cut it with a gas-powered chainsaw, you may not be having any kind of a positive effect on the amount of carbon.
Exactly.
I'm going to plug a book that has a lot of information about biochar. It's called Burn by Albert Bates and Kathleen Drapier. I read that last year and got a lot out of it. It's a wealth of great ideas that a group like yours could be helping to push forward. So we've talked about the engineered solutions, the biological solutions. What about the hybrid of the two? Explain that. Do you have examples of what that might be?
Yeah, the hybrid solutions are really just a combination of the land-based and tech-based system. So it's about converting the nature-based storage of CO2 into a more permanent or durable form. The technology that's most often referred to as a hybrid solution is one that's called bioenergy with carbon capture or storage, or for shorthand, BECCS. So usually that's converting biomass, and again, that's things like corn or trees, really burning that and converting it into energy, and that can be electricity or fuels. And then when you burn the biomass, you actually get a stream of CO2 that you can then store underground. And so there's one example of this in the United States. It's an ADM corn ethanol plant that's located in Illinois, where they're fermenting corn, creating ethanol, capturing the CO2, and storing it underground. And this is a project that, in part, was funded and supported by the Department of Energy to really test out these technologies.
So some of these ideas are kind of a bridge, aren't they, toward maybe a greater solution in the future? Because they make a market, they create a market for the carbon. Can you kind of expand on that idea?
Yeah. And I think it's just important to note that when we're talking about the conversion of carbon to these products, that the end product really matters. So some products like fuels and chemicals, because when you use them or burn them, if you put ethanol in your car and drive around, you actually are releasing a lot of that carbon back in the atmosphere. So we're always trying to go towards more permanent forms of these solutions so that the carbon can be stored over long terms and have the biggest climate benefit.
I'm a fan of that as well. You know, the idea of not so much can we separate the carbon dioxide molecules, which is really a small amount of what's in the atmosphere, mm-hmm. but then that's in a gaseous form. And really that oxygen, we would like to have that back in the atmosphere. And it's really mm-hmm. the carbon that you'd like to store away. It's
absolutely.
Carbon dioxide is a really insidious thing because I don't know if people know this, but a gallon of gasoline weighs 6 pounds roughly. Some people know that a gallon of water weighs 8 pounds. Water has oxygen, which is a heavier molecule. But that gallon of gasoline, of those molecules, which are basically just carbon and hydrogen, the carbon is 5 of those 6 pounds. So every gallon of gasoline that you burn is like a chunk of carbon that weighs 5 pounds that's dissolved into the atmosphere. And solid carbon can be in a lot of different forms. We're all familiar with a pencil lead, kind of a graphite form. If you had a 5 pound piece of pencil lead, it's 4 inches by 4 inches by 4 inches. That's a pretty large piece of carbon for every gallon of gasoline that we burn through our cars. But it's insidious because you don't smell it, you don't see it, it just dissolves and seems to go away magically and produce all this energy. So that was a little aside.
One of the tough things about solving climate change is that it is a problem where you can't see the quote-unquote pollution, and hopefully carbon removal solutions can sort of help connect us back to that carbon cycle and give us, you know, a personal relationship with the way that carbon flows through our world.
Yeah. Well, I have a favorite that I've been following in the hybrid kind of space. It's a product, it doesn't exist yet, but hopefully it will. They've branded it SkyClean. It's basically a jet fuel made by the pyrolysis process that we talked about with biofuels. And it's out of the brain of one of my engineering heroes, a Danish engineer named Henrik Stisdal. And he was one of the pioneers in wind energy in terms of making it scalable and profitable and advanced. So now in retirement, he's got a company and he's doing 3 things. And one of them is this SkyClean. And I'm excited about that because it would take clean electricity, say from wind or solar, which this area has a lot of wind and sometimes excess wind. And then it would use feedstocks from agriculture, like the corn stalks or the wheat chaff, and then you would burn that in the absence of oxygen, combine it with some hydrogen that you get through green electrolysis, convert it into jet fuel, which if we're going to continue with a modern society, there probably aren't ways to power a jet plane other than some sort of a dense fuel. But at the end of it, when you balance it all out, more carbon is captured than released. So slowly over time, it would put more carbon that could then be amended into the soils of agricultural areas. I think this is a good example.
Yeah, it's a great example of a hybrid solution and really an indicator of how carbon removal solutions can help with these very difficult to decarbonize sectors. Very hard for us to find cost-effective solutions for things like aviation. And so innovations like that can really fill big gaps in the climate fight.
So part of your role and NOAA's role, do you go try to influence policy? And is it just on the federal level or do you also work in the state level?
It's definitely a big portion of our work. We're really focused on how can we leverage the power specifically of the federal government to both develop and deploy these solutions. In the U.S., we have a really strong history of technology development and innovation. So how can we harness the power of our federal agencies to make these solutions a reality? And a lot of that work is about, you know, doing the policy development to think about how do we develop these solutions in a really responsible way, educating members of Congress on what these solutions are, why they're important, and why they matter to their districts, and then building the coalitions of people who can show that these solutions are important and sort of change the political will around a lot of these conversations. That's a big bulk of our work and an area which I think we can make a lot of change in a short period of time.
Yeah, that's great. So in Kansas, I know Kansas the best because I live in Kansas and I'm a Kansan. We are struggling to try to reorganize and make an energy office that reports up through the governor's office. That hasn't happened yet. That's sort of the first step towards getting a statewide energy policy plan. Kansas is one of the few states that doesn't have that. Even though we've got tons of wind and it's growing and everybody is so excited about what that's doing for our economy, and we've got the potential for solar. But I think there's a lot of other ideas with the agriculture, with the new carbon economy that we're talking about. And I would love to see you guys get in front of, you know, our legislators to explain some of this to them. So good on you for doing this. We're wrapping up. Are there other answers that you would have liked to have given had I been astute enough to ask the right question?
I think you asked excellent questions. But I think the big question for us at Carbon 180 is how do we really scale these solutions? We know that carbon removal solutions are a critical part of solving climate change. And we talked about a number of the tools that we have in our toolbox to get there. But in order to make a difference in the climate fight, we really need to bring these solutions to scale quickly. So on the tech side, that's how do we use innovation to bring down costs? On the land side, it's how do we create markets to scale durable changes in land management practices? And so I think those are some of the questions that keep me up at night. And what I think our work comes down to at Carbon 180, which we just started to touch upon, is about activating change makers. So getting state and federal governments to fund research, development, and demonstration of these solutions, and getting companies to incorporate these products in their supply chains or as part of their corporate sustainability commitments. And I would just, you know, encourage all of your listeners to think about the power of their civic engagement and action in their community, because really, to build the new carbon economy, we're going to all sort of have to take part in shaping what this new world looks like.
Amen. Tell us your website one more time.
It's carbon180.org.
Great. Well, Gianna, thank you very much for taking time to be on Eco Radio KC. I appreciate what you're doing so much, and keep up the good work.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
It was fun for me, too. So as always, tonight's show is going to be available as an audio file on Eco Radio KC's page at kkfi.org. All right. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
I am Angela Belize. I can remember being a young girl watching television. The majority of the roles were led by white women. My Barbie dolls were white, so forth and so on. This is one of the many facets of systematic racism. In media, we have the opportunity to show the unspoken, shine the light where it needs to be shown, and present opportunities where they've been oppressed. I would like to ask you to help us here at KKFI to create equality, equity, and the long overdue justice for the Black community. To give your suggestions, ideas, and how to be involved, please email angelabelieves@angelaisabeliever@gmail.com.
Here's the calendar of events for the week of July 27th. Experience Butterflies' annual migration from the Midwest to Mexico at the annual Festival of Butterflies at Powell Gardens, July 24th to August 9th. Find information at palgardens.org. Kansas City Community Gardens Fall Plant Sale will be July 24th to August 15th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. As you begin planning your fall plantings, you can find cool season vegetable plants at Kansas City Community Gardens Fall Sale. More info at kccg.org or call 816-931-3877. The Blue River documentary film series will begin on Monday, July 27 from 7 to 8 p.m. The film series will be broadcast through Zoom. Get movie tickets at Heartland Conservation Alliance. The events are free, but organizers suggest a donation to help fund efforts to restore the Blue River. La Charrette, near present-day Marthasville, was the westernmost trading settlement on the Missouri River at the turn of the century. Wednesday, July 29th, 4 to 5 p.m., there's a free family program called Growing Up with the River. Access info at mohumanities.org. People can learn more about rain gardens in the Missouri Department of Conservation's free virtual program, Rain Garden Tour. This is online, 10 to 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, July 29th. People can register at mdc.mo.gov. Green Business Network is July 30, 2 p.m., info at bridgingthegap.org. Staying Healthy at Home, Friday, July 31st, 3 to 3:30 p.m., online event for adults. Monica Miller, Nutrition Program Associate for University of Missouri Extension, presents a short lesson on gardening at home. RSVP at kclibrary.org. Please listen to Eco Radio KC next week. These items and more can be viewed at the Eco Radio KC Facebook page. Stay tuned now for Fiesta Musical.
A 4,000-year drought in the Southwest? It could happen. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
New research conducted in a cave in Nevada is revealing some dire implications for the American Southwest.
Scientists at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, studied stalagmite specimens from a cave in the wilderness of the Great Basin and have found that the state was even hotter and drier in the past than it is now.
Stalagmites act as rain gauges, recording climate data. They grow upward at a rate of inches every few hundred years as groundwater drips from stalactites on the ceiling.
The resulting stalagmites hold data from a 13,000-year period, more than tree rings, and show a long-term shift toward a more arid climate.
The scientists conclude that hot and dry conditions existed during a 4,000-year period that was linked to warm waters in the Arctic and a lack of sea ice, similar to what's happening today.
If the same pattern occurs, then water supply in the Colorado River Basin is expected to decrease, which researchers say would imperil a critical resource for millions of people.
A group of heavy hitters from the world of finance have warned of economic disaster without urgent action on climate change.
70 executives sent a letter to Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell warning that the climate crisis may cause the value of some companies to plummet, which could ricochet through the economy.
The signatories said tens of millions of people in the country could suffer, but their focus was on the stability of financial markets and the economic competitiveness of the U.S.
The leaders urge regulatory agencies to require companies to disclose the risks that climate change poses to their businesses and the location of their physical assets, like factories, so investors can gauge threats from wildfires, hurricanes, or floods.
If companies are forced to make those disclosures, the New York Times reports it could motivate them to lower their greenhouse gas emissions or risk losing access to investments or insurance coverage.
Banks should also be required to factor climate change into commercial loans. The Rainforest Action Network reported in March that 35 global banks have been expanding loans to the fossil fuel sector in the 4 years since the signing of the Paris Climate Agreement.
The letter says that immediate action to address climate change is crucial, as financial markets are particularly vulnerable from the economic shocks of the COVID-19 pandemic.
There's a mysterious sinkhole off the Gulf Coast of Florida, about 150 feet below the surface.
The underwater phenomenon, called a blue hole, is similar to sinkholes that occur on land and is just one of many scattered across Florida's continental shelf that vary in size, shape, and depth. According to NOAA, blue holes are ecological hotspots with a diversity of plants and animals, including corals, sponges, mollusks, sea turtles, and sharks.
This particular blue hole hole, which is about 450 feet deep and 300 feet across, is called the Green Banana and may be one of the deepest ever discovered.
According to the New York Times, the name came in the mid-1970s after a boat captain saw a green banana skin floating by a spring, as fishermen called the underwater sinkholes back then.
Scientists are going to explore the Green Banana next month by lowering a 600-pound lander carrying scientific instruments into the hole.
The researchers are hoping to understand if the blue hole harbors new species of microbes. They will also examine how the sinkholes affect the global carbon cycle, according to CBS News. The amount of plastic trash piling up in our oceans every year is expected to nearly triple by 2040.
According to a new report, if no action is taken to stem the growth in the amount we produce and consume, it will be like dumping nearly 110 pounds of plastic on every meter of coastline around the world.
The study led by the Pew Charitable Trusts finds that although progress has been made in addressing the global problem, current commitments by government and industry will reduce plastic pollution by only less than 7% over the next 20 years.
But the authors say there is something that can be done, like substituting plastics with paper and compostable materials, designing products and packaging for recycling, and increasing reuse rates in middle and low-income countries. And finally, the drug remdesivir is currently a treatment for people severely sick with COVID-19, but it doesn't always work for every patient. As cases spike around the world, researchers are looking at other possible drugs.
One place they may want to look is underwater. Researchers at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute have found that a seaweed extract called heparin may be more effective in blocking coronavirus than remdesivir.
Heparin is a common blood thinner, and the scientists are seeing its potential to behave as a decoy to trick the virus.
The COVID-19 virus sickens people by latching onto a cell's surface. It hijacks the cell by inserting genetic material inside to replicate itself.
But the virus could just as easily lock onto a decoy molecule that has a similar fit and size. The decoy would neutralize and trap the virus, which would then naturally degrade.
The experts say extracts from seaweed worked as well or better than remdesivir, and previous research showed that this technique works on other viruses like dengue and Zika.
The team says that since COVID-19 infections likely start in the nose, these compounds could be used in a nasal spray to treat the virus early and block it from entering the body.
The research reaffirms that our oceans contain an untold number of medicines, provided we protect them.
That's it for this week in Water. We'll catch you next time.